Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Alan Chartok. Lainey Salisbury has had a successful and varied career as a journalist, working as an editor and a reporter in New York, a foreign correspondent, and an award-winning author. A graduate of Penn and the Columbia School of Journalism, Salisbury has lectured at the University at Albany Journalism Program since 2007. This fall, she will assume a new position there as visiting assistant professor. Lainey Salisbury, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little about your career. Where were you?
I've been sort of all over in the beginning. I was in Africa for a while, in Zimbabwe, in southern Africa, and went back to New York and then in the Middle East, mostly in Jordan.
So who were you working for?
I was a freelancer back then.
Interesting. How does one freelance? I mean, that's so interesting. And you go to Africa and you say, okay, let's see what I can round up and then let's see who I can sell it to?
A little bit. I did a little more legwork in the beginning. I mean, I called a couple newspapers and asked if they'd be interested. And I got some tips from people who had done it before. And what seemed important at the time was not to go to a place that was a big news story, to try to find one of those countries that had an interesting story to tell but was always being overlooked.
So, for example?
Zimbabwe was sort of one of those examples. It was next to South Africa, which was a big story. Nelson Mandela was about to be released. Apartheid was coming to an end. And Zimbabwe was sort of a listening post for many reporters who couldn't get into South Africa. So I went there and met a lot of people in that country, you know, reporters and locals. And, you know, through them also got a lot of work, because many of them had too much work to do and they would pass it off to me, which was great.
And you could make a living?
I could. And, you know, cost of living there is much lower. But I also knew that I was gaining a lot of experience. I think most of my learning came from working with people who are much more experienced and seasoned than I was.
You said you learned something, and that was one of your greatest learning experiences. But you started with an extraordinary entrepreneurial spirit, which, you know, I've taught for a long time, is very rare among younger people, isn't it?
I don't know. You know, it wasn't for me. I had a strong desire to see the world. I knew that the type of person I was, that once I got a job and was in an office, I would work hard at it and probably never leave. And I felt that in my 20s, I had a lot of room to make mistakes and people would understand. So that was the time to go take risks.
But you're talking to students now. You have since 2007. Are you getting the kinds of students who would follow along with what you've done and say, okay, you know, the hell with everything else, I'm going to Africa?
It wasn't so much like I went off by the seat of my pants. I had made contact with a local newspaper in Harare, which was the capital in Zimbabwe at the time. So I did actually have a job to go to when I went there. So I, in a sense, also played it safe. I didn't want to fall flat on my face in a foreign country and not be able to have enough money to get back home. So I try to encourage them to take risks, but to also do in a way that you're never stuck anywhere.
Uh-huh. A sort of a balanced.
Yeah.
So was there culture shock when you got there?
I loved it. I like culture shock. So
what did you love?
You know, and what was sort of interesting is, you know, I'm white, and to be in a country where I am the minority, I mean, that was kind of an interesting perspective on the world alone. Just that alone was sort of not shocking to me, but it sort of gave me a much better idea of what life is like for minorities in the U.S.
What about being female in a situation like that? You're alone. How did you handle that?
I mean, I took precautions. I was careful not to walk around late at night. Zimbabwe at the time was a peaceful country. It's not now. I made a lot of friends there, so we did sort of go out in packs. You know, I had more difficulty when I was in Jordan in the Middle East as a woman. I found that I had trouble even just going to the store sometimes.
So what was that like?
It was wearing and it was difficult, and it kind of made for a more isolating life.
Was there a specific memory of walking into a grocery store and really being sort of shunted aside?
I mean, this was not very smart of me, but I'm the kind of person that have a lot of energy and I need to somehow have exercise every day. So I purposely woke up really early one morning in Amman and went for a jog. It was about like 4:30 in the morning. I thought this is the only time I could do this, but you know, but 10 minutes into it, you know, I had two men jogging behind me, following me, whistling at me, and, you know, not quite understanding why I was doing it. Or they felt, I mean, they I guess they thought I was, you know, interested in meeting other men this way. I So I just kept running. And I was wearing sweatpants and sweatshirts, you know, I was being appropriately dressed.
But did you run faster?
Yes, I did.
What's the most important story you ever worked on?
Wasn't so much important, but, you know, early on, I wrote a story about a man from Iran who was gay, and he was trying to seek asylum in the country based on his gender orientation, his sexual orientation, and it was sort of a test case. And the first time this was being tried out in the U.S. And I think that story affected me a lot in terms of just how much power the press has, because when I was writing the story at the time, I didn't appreciate that it was a quote-unquote big story. And it was for the AP, and it was probably picked up in every newspaper. And I think it generated other stories and other kinds of attention that I was completely unaware of. So in a sense, that was the most important story, I guess, for my understanding of the power of journalism. And, you know, I do tell my students this, that when I started journalism, I didn't do it because I felt like I had to protect democracy or that I had this great yearning to ensure America remained free. I really got into it in the beginning because I loved to write and I loved to travel and I loved to have adventures, and this seemed to be the career that would allow me to do that. But as I get older and I'm more educated and I understand history better, now I'm starting to realize that just how important this profession is, and that everyone needs to really understand that the power of the press can, you know, we can crush people within this job, and we can crush the guilty, and we can also crush the innocent. So you also have to be extremely careful with what you do.
Can you give me an example of an event which you think crushed the innocent?
You know, what comes to mind is Richard Jewell. You remember he was considered, if I get the story right, but he was, for a while, he was the person of interest in the bombing in Atlanta, Georgia.
Sure.
And his life was ruined, sort of from the behavior of the press and even also the behavior of officials. But, you know, I guess with that story, you know, all the ethics seem to have gone out the window.
He sued and got a lot of money.
He did. Yeah, he won. But he still, I can pull him out of memory, you know, and how many other people can too. You know, I feel sorry for him because he always had to live with the stigma.
I want to remind everybody that we are talking to Lainey Salisbury, who is visiting professor at SUNY at Albany in journalism. Are students, Lainey, being attracted in large numbers to journalism?
It seems so. Apparently it's one of the more popular majors on campus.
What do you attribute that to?
I think just the opening up of the various kinds of mediums for people to write and to show their writing. I mean, everyone argues now that everyone can be a journalist and everyone can be read. And there's, I think, an appeal to that quality of journalism. And I think everyone, no matter who you are, sort of has a need to be heard. So I think that's appealing to students. You know, they can set up a blog and they can start writing and call themselves a journalist, and people will listen to them and they can start, you know, quote-unquote, informing people.
I have another theory. My theory is that there are very few vocational tracks in liberal arts institutions, and that journalism is one of them, and that, therefore, with the incredible pressure to get a job after you get out, that people think that journalism is one way to go.
Yes. I mean, and it's also not, I mean, I tell this to my students all the time. Journalism is not rocket science. I mean, you don't have to be extremely intelligent and smart to practice it. You do have to be a critical thinker, and you do have to work hard. But we're all capable of being really great at this profession. We don't need a special talent. We can hone our writing skills. It's a craft. There is an academic element as well to it when you get into the history and the ethics and the law and, you know, studying various types of journalism. But, you know, I tell them that they all have the power to accomplish this. It's really just a question of their putting in the work.
Lainey Salisbury, you've written some books. What have they been about?
Both of them were narrative nonfiction, and I had a co-author on both of them. The first one was really just appealed to my adventurous side, and that was recreating a diphtheria epidemic in Nome, Alaska in 1925.
Wow.
And brought in a lot of history of Alaska and history of the dog sleds and how they developed and history of medicine. And, you know, the best way to sort of sum up that book is that it's the adult story of the dog Balto. There's a statue of him in Central Park that pretty much has never been told. It's always been treated as a children's story, but it's a much larger story because it occurred at a time in Alaska history that was sort of the end of a chapter and the beginning of a new one. And this event was sort of iconic in the making of Alaska as we know it today.
So what did Balto do?
Well, Balto was as brave and courageous and dedicated as all the other sled dogs, but there were 150 sled dogs that raced in a relay with dog drivers to bring medicine about 700 miles to Nome, which was locked in by snow and ice. There was the worst weather on record in Alaska, and children were dying, and they had to get this medicine so the town wouldn't be wiped out by this disease. We're now all vaccinated for diphtheria, but back then the vaccine hadn't been invented yet.
What was your other book about?
The other one was about an art forgery case, which happened in, it was centered in London about 12 years ago, and it follows the tale of a con man who conned a very good painter who discovered his talent at forging, and they pretty much scammed the art market for 10 years. So he is, the con man is sort of an interesting sort of psychological profile. He's part pathological liar, part, I don't know what you could even call it, but he was not quite a balanced individual. He was great at pulling off this scam for 10 years, and no one was able to catch him until the very, very end.
Did you find anything appealing about him?
I admired his audacity and his ability to tell a lie without breaking into a sweat. He conned so many people with confidence. You know, I admired that because I certainly can't do that. And, you know, the person I found appealing was the woman who was responsible for bringing the scheme to an end.
Who was that?
Her name was Mary Lisa Palmer, and she was the head of the Giacometti Association because one of Giacometti's were being forged. And the entire art industry kept trying to sell these works because they kept looking at the paperwork to the works and not at the works themselves, saying, well, this, even though this work is not very good, it has to be authentic because I have the paperwork. And when people tried to start passing off the Giacometti's, she just put her foot down and said, I don't care what the paperwork says. She had confidence in herself. You know, this work is a fake. It's not done by the master. I can tell. And, you know, take your paperwork away. I'm not going to sell it.
Well, first of all, what's the name of the book?
Provenance.
Secondly, did you talk to the forger himself?
Oh, yeah. No, I talked to him a lot.
And how was that?
He struck me as someone who, you know, he wasn't born to crime. His circumstances were such that I think he felt he had no other options but to commit this crime. In the beginning, he thought that there were no victims to art forgery, but there were. I mean, crime has ripple effects. And he was just trying to find a way to support his two young children. His wife had left him, and he was broke. He lived out in the middle of the country. And this, you know, dashing man claiming to be a nuclear physicist with an art collection and also a business on the side of dealing art sort of slowly roped this isolated man in and conned him, too.
Do you see anything tragic about him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, con men have this ability to sort of hold a mirror up to all your dreams, and they present themselves in such a way that they can make these dreams happen for you. And, you know, I feel sorry, you know, and many people are conned by con artists, and often they don't even know it. Usually it's by someone you do know. They tend to be, you know, within your circle of friends and acquaintances. And it's just sort of tragic because, in one sense, this forger, like everyone else who has experienced this, you know, their trust in the world is really damaged. And they have trouble seeing other people with 100% faith again.
Was the heroine as forgiving towards the man she exposed as you are?
No.
She was angry.
She very, and I don't blame her. She devoted her entire life to protecting the legacy of this artist, Giacometti. So for someone to come in and start forging, I mean, it was like a personal insult.
How did you find these two books in the first place? What put you onto them?
I went story hunting. Part of what I teach in basic reporting and writing one class is to how to hunt for stories. So, you know, I went looking for something that, one, I wanted to spend time with, something that interested me and appealed to me, and also that I would think would appeal to readers. I mean, there's no point, I think, in my sense, to write a book that no one wants to read. That'd be my diary, you know.
Is there that aha Excelsior moment when you say, okay, this is the one, this is what I want to do? Or is it a precedent?
I think sometimes, you know, you have to do research into it and know a little bit about it before that aha moment comes. But there is a moment when suddenly you sort of see, wow, this is a fascinating character who represents something for many people. And this is a great story. And it looks like this could be a climax. And this looks like a resolution. And, you know, so you can sort of see the outline. And then, yeah, there's a little bit of an aha. Let's go for it.
You know, I'll be honest with you, Lainey Salisbury, I think your students are very, very lucky that you're going to be teaching them and have been teaching them these years, because it sounds to me like you have some real life lessons to teach them about. And as opposed to guys who open up textbooks and just turn the pages, you can transmit some of this passion you have for the profession. And I want to thank you because we all love the journalism department at the University of Albany, at least I do, and our producer Ian Pickus does. And we wish you all the best in your new pursuit as visiting assistant professor at the University of Albany at the Albany Journalism Program. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Thanks again, Lainey.
Thank you. That was fun.